said. "There is no time for debate, Castor. You will go now and link with Lieutenant Tyrannus. That is an order." Castor bowed his head briefly, clearly swallowing a bitter protest. "Until we meet again, brother captain," he said, making the double gauntlet salute of the Primaris. "Courage and honor," Demeter replied. Polixis. The Hellblasters opened fire. Four beams of blue brilliance lit up the darkness, the sunburst flare of plasma weaponry further enhanced by the reflective properties of the dust cloud. The leading orcs were reduced to swirls of ash and burning embers, the stench of atomized innards immediately filling the clogged air. The aliens' roars redoubled as those behind realized they finally found opposition in the ruined city. The crack of plasma was answered by the crude hammer of slug weapons as the greenskins returned fire, an inaccurate hail of hard rounds filling the air and ploughing the rubble around Polixis. He ignored the fusillade and ran to the side of Victus and Ennio.
"I've had worse," the latter said, as Victus helped pull him to his feet.
His power armor was battered and scarred, but his left arm, from the vambrace down, had taken the worst of the impact. It had been crushed while shielding his head from the workhouse's collapse. Polixis didn't need to run a diagnostic scan to know it would require complete restructuring, perhaps amputation.
"See to Trejo, brother apothecary," Victus said, unclamping his bolt pistol with his right hand.
Behind him, Polixis saw that Otho and Marius had finally dug down to the last of their trapped battle brothers.
"Both legs," Trejo said, his tone not quite masking the pain in his voice.
He was seated, and blood was oozing from half a dozen ruptures in his thigh and shin plates. Polixis knelt swiftly and stabbed an adrenaline shot into his tacit port.
"That'll keep you going for now," he said, motioning to Otho and Marius. "You'll have to lift him clear." "We must withdraw, brother apothecary," Domitian said.
The Hellblasters covering the rest of the squad had set their incinerators to rapid fire, dangerously close to the overcharge setting that would unleash searing destruction at the risk of fatal malfunctions to the volatile plasma cores. Streak after streak of blue light whipped away the oncoming greenskins, their scrap armor, furs, and hides as impotent a protection as their thick skin and bones. There were too many, however, to hold back for more than a few moments. The brilliant bolts unleashed by Gratian, Junarius, Lawrence, and Luco were also serving to draw more orcs towards them, threatening to overwhelm their flanks, or, worse, cut them off entirely. Otho and Marius had Trejo lifted between them, signaling their readiness with blink-click confirmations. Polixis stood by them as they worked their way down from the mound of excavated rubble to more stable ground.
"Formation ardent," Domitian said,
ordering a defensive withdrawal focused around protecting Trejo. The rest of the Hellblasters closed smoothly around their wounded comrade, paying no heed to the hard rounds whipping the dust-choked air and cracking from their power armor. Ennio joined Polixis, his incinerator hefted in his remaining good arm. Domitian and Victus took up the rear, laying down rapid, accurate bursts of fire from their assault plasma incinerators. The squad didn't get far before it became apparent that it was too late to disengage. The greenskins, coming from the rock, hadn't arrived in a single group as expected, but moved northwards like a bloodthirsty tide. While Squad Domitian had stemmed it for 100 yards just east of the Gorgon, the rest of it had flowed on around them. Now, as they tried to pull away, it threatened to come crashing in from either side. Greenskins were closing from almost every direction, and the air itself vibrated with their battle frenzy. Polixis fired to his right as he kept pace with the rest of the squad, moving at an ungainly half-run while they ensured Trejo was shielded at the center of their small phalanx.
"Squad Domitian, we are inbound!" crackled the voice of Sergeant Clastis.
The intercessors were withdrawing from the riverbank, and Clastis's route to the east would carry them close to the Hellblasters as they tried to force their way northwards. A glance at the tactical display told Polixis they'd be too late. It would take at least 10 minutes to link up, minutes they no longer had. The first green skin broke through to them. It threw itself at Brother Luca with a howl, a huge cleaver slamming into the Hellblaster's right pauldron, and lodging there, splitting the dust-caked chapter crest. Luca fired with barely a yard between him and the greenskin. The plasma bolt turned the orc to ash and fused the whole right side of the Primaris armor's ceramite. Luca tugged the cleaver free in time to fling it deftly into the chest of the second beast to run at him. By then, a third was grappling with Junarius. The squad was overrun. Polixis slipped his gladius from its black plastic sheath and turned it, point downwards, continuing to fire with his bolt pistol into the onrushing aliens. One directly ahead of him collapsed with its throat torn out by an explosive round. Another had its thick skull blown apart in a shower of grey matter. The pistol's chamber clicked empty. There was no time to reload. He spun the gladius once more and lunged into the charge of the next orc to come at him, the world around him seeming to slow as the full force of his enhanced combat biology took over. Everything became smaller and simpler. Existence was reduced to nothing but his blade and the bared weak points of the alien's vile physiology. The first orc to die by his sword did so with it rammed up through the soft palate of its jaw, the wicked tip of the razored vibrasteel punching into its small brain. A twist of the wrist and a violent tug, and the short blade was free and swinging once more. An open throat to his right, a short, sharp jab through an eye socket to the left, two more twitching dead greenskins at his feet. The apothecary's motions were little removed from the way he slit flesh and sawed bone on the operating table. Conservative, precise, powerful, unlike the wrathful hammer blows delivered by his younger brother. He sensed dark alien blood splattering the dust already caking his white battleplate, creating a foul patina, and the stink of the orc's opened innards penetrated the filters of his armor. A chill part of his mind, far detached from the adrenaline-fueled bloodletting, observed the emotions that drove each killing blow. It found little of the passion and fury, the fire and zealotry that put strength into Castor's arm. Instead, there was a cold disgust, coupled with a juxtaposition, the desire to protect. Castor, like many of the Adeptus Astartes, killed the Xenos because he hated them. Polixis killed the Xenos because, first and foremost, he wished to preserve the lives of his brothers and those they had come to protect. Something hit the apothecary's backpack, hard. He grunted, taking a step forwards and allowing the blow to jar right along his pauldron. As it did so, he turned sharply to the left, gladius a blur. The greenskin brought down Brother Lawrence, cleaving his helm and skull, and smashing its way to the center of the ardent formation. It parried Polixis's gladius with the haft of its bloodied battle-axe. Polixis took another half-step back, giving him room to turn the swing into a thrust that dug into the scarred meat of the alien's upper arm. It grunted and drove itself against the apothecary, its stinking, solid bulk crackling off his breastplate, the spikes adorning its rusting armor, gouging marks in the ceramite. Polixis shifted his grip on his gladius and tried to cut left, sawing into its trunk-like neck, but the beast was too close, and the blow only gouged deeper into its shoulder. The thing was in his face, snapping its tusks just inches from his visor, the bush's stench of its maw filling his senses. He couldn't get his gladius clear to stab for a vital point, so he forced it deeper into the alien's shoulder, driving it into tough Xenos muscle, trying to angle for its throat. The orc grappled with him, seemingly impervious to the blade digging into its flesh. Polixis's armor began to flash warning sigils as it was locked in a death grip, ceramite and servo straining against the alien's iron-hard muscles. The apothecary released his gladius and blink-activated his narthesium. Both the reductor chain blade and the drill bit buzzed to life. He plunged them into the orc's flank, teeth gritted. The beast roared and loosened its grip as it tried to grapple with his arm. Polixis used the opportunity to rip himself away from the orc and lightning-fast whipped the reductor's chainblade across its throat. Blood burst, and the alien stumbled, choking and snarling, as its lungs filled with fluid. Polixis delivered a short, hard kick to its left kneecap, bringing it down as it died. He deactivated his Narthesium, blood spraying from its chainblades, reloaded his pistol, and dragged his gladius from the dead orc's shoulder. The slaughter continued. Around him, he could see Squad Domitian was almost overrun. All bar Trejo, Otho, and Marius were fighting hand to hand now, gladius, chainswords, and pistols drawn. Greenskins were coming from the darkness on all sides, bellowing for blood, heedless of the orc corpses that already lay thick around the Primaris. Lawrence was still down, and his vitae signs had turned red on Polixus's visor. He pushed past Marius, Otho, and Trejo, all three now firing one-handed point-blank bursts of plasma into the surrounding Xenos, searing them away even as more charged into the melee. The apothecary cut down two more orcs standing between him and Lawrence's prone body, bolt rounds hammering fist-size holes in the aliens' torsos. More rushed in, their boots grinding over the fallen Primaris's body.
"Stand fast, apothecary!"
Domitian's voice rang out as he pushed past with his plasma pistol raised. Its vents were glowing white-hot, steam rising from its coils as they overheated. More orcs were blown away, but it made no difference. They kept coming, the broken city resounding with their animalistic frenzy. A sudden rage gripped Polixis. The icy detachment that had driven him before melted, and he lunged into the press, firing his reloaded bolt pistol left and right. Something far closer to the emotion channeled by his brother was rising up inside him as he discharged round after round into the aliens surrounding him, eyes fixed on Lawrence's body just ahead, and on the boots that trampled and defiled it. His mind locked onto the desire to reach those sacred remains, to defend and preserve the precious flesh within. If the progenoids were not safely retrieved, he would not only have failed Lawrence and Squad Domitian, but all future generations that could have been spawned from the warrior's genetic inheritance. A light lit the gloom, the blaze of fire rather than the actinic blue of a plasma discharge. Too late, Polixis realized one of the greenskins mere feet away was hauling a crude flamer, the rusting tanks strapped to its back sloshing with some form of volatile chemical. It had a blackened metal visor lowered over its face, and Polixis could hear its manic cackling even over the thump of blades and the hammer of weapons discharges all around. The pilot flame on the nozzle of its weapon flared and died. The greenskin's laugh turned to a grunt of annoyance as it gave the tanks on its back a heavy blow with its fist, but the light didn't reignite. The brute turned in a half-circle, then bellowed with anger when it realized something had cut the greasy pipelines running between the canisters and the weapon's nozzle, spilling stinking fuel around its feet. A shadow loomed in the darkness behind it. A long blade slashed like a flicker of lightning, there and gone again in one precise motion. The orc's bellow was cut abruptly short, and blood gouted from its severed jugular. It swayed for a moment, apparently unable to comprehend that it had just been killed, then collapsed into the spreading puddle of fuel still gushing from its flamer tanks. The shadow was gone. For the first time, Polixis became aware of a shift in the melee around him. There was a new dynamic, the thud of heavy bolt pistols and the keening, razored whisper of combat knives parting flesh and muscle. More dark shapes darted to his left and right, and abruptly the press began to lessen. The rush of greenskins had been reduced to a scattering, orcs turning in confusion and firing blindly into the dust, as members of their mob dropped with open throats and torsos, shredded by point-blank heavy bolt rounds.
"Brothers!"
Sergeant Domitian voxed, as simultaneous realization reached the Hellblasters and the apothecary. One of the shadows materialized in their midst. It was as tall as any of the Primaris around it, and by all rights should not have been capable of such stealth. Its armor, while bearing many similarities to that worn by other ultramarines, was more streamlined and form-fitting, eschewing the heavily plated bulk of the standard Mark X for silent black servo bundles and shaped ceramite plates that hugged thighs, torso, and arms. Most striking of all was the warrior's helmet, The visor had been molded into the likeness of a grinning skull, painted white to match, the two eye sockets glowing with the ruby redness of probing autosense lenses. It reminded Polixis of his brother.
"Brother Sergeant Severus," he said.
The Reaver inclined his head slightly, his voice a cold whisper issuing from his death mask's vocalizer.
"Brother Apothecary, I am here to extract you."
"Through happy coincidence, or did Chaplain Castor send you?"
"I have my orders,"
Severus replied levelly.
"We must move before the Xenos encircle us once more."
Polixis looked to Trajo, still held up by his battle brothers. He was sure that even with the Primaris' advanced biology, the Hellblaster was struggling with the pain of his shattered legs. The apothecary turned to Domitian. The sergeant had hefted Lorenz's body in his arms, servos grinding as they accommodated the Primaris' great weight.
"We are ready," he said. "I can extract his progenoids here," Polixis began. "He comes with us, apothecary. Let us be gone from here before an even greater sacrifice is required."
Severus's Reaver brethren were still only half-suggested shapes in the surrounding shadows, backlit occasionally by the flare of their heavy bolt pistols. They watched over the Hellblasters as they withdrew to the northeast, veiled, half-glimpsed figures who brought swift death to everything in their path. Severus himself had departed once more from the Hellblasters without Polixis noticing, simply disappearing from the midst of the battered ultramarines. The sound of bolter fire from off to their right intensified, followed by the whip-crack of lascannon discharges.
"Is that Extremis?" Domitian wondered aloud.
Polixis tapped into the visor map's sigil overlay. Atlantis told him that the Demi Company's repulsor grav tank was indeed just to their east, and heading in the opposite direction.
"Captain Demeter is with it," he said aloud. "It seems he's counterattacking into the Horde." "That is madness," Domitian said. "He'll be overrun."
"Our orders are to continue the withdrawal,"
Severus interjected over the vox.
"The captain is buying us time," Polixis said. "The orcs will flock to him, and especially Extremis."
He could sense Sergeant Domitian's struggle. The Hellblasters were now the closest Primaris to the captain. They could support him, but the reasoning behind Demeter's counterattack was obvious. It was to allow them to withdraw. They all had their orders.
"We continue northeast," the sergeant said eventually. "Maintain formation and watch the flanks, and may the Primarch and the Emperor be with the captain."
Stabskar. Stabskar watched the big beakies withdraw into the cover of the dust shroud. He said nothing, but the expression on his blunt, scarred face was clear enough, anger mixed with a rare degree of uncertainty. The orc commandos had sniffed out the beaky ambush seconds before it had been sprung. Never had either Stabskar or his biggest knob, Grimtooth, witnessed the blue boys act so sneaky-like before. Luckily, Grimtooth had sniffed out the counter-ambush at the last minute, and Stabskar had ordered the lads to restrain themselves. Stabskar wasn't going to waste lads against any old beaky band. That was what the foot-slogging mobs were for. So the commandos held back, and now their prey was slipping away into the rubble and the night.
"I reckon that was him, boss,"
Grimtooth growled from where he was kneeling atop the nearest mound of debris, peering through the spotting tube after the withdrawing figures.
"I reckon that's the one in the white bits." "You don't know what you're talking about,"
Stabskar huffed, unwilling to admit that the target set for him by Urgork was potentially escaping.
"Could be any git out there. We'll find the one the boss wants, and soon."
The crump of a large explosion, followed by a swelling roar to the east, drew the commando's attention away from the receding Primaris.
"More beakies,"
Grimtooth hypothesized, peering through the dust.
"Come in this way." "Probably just trying to distract the mobs," Stabskar said. Let's take a look.
The commando boss led his band around the rubble mounds, moving low and fast, soot-smeared stabbing knives unsheathed. A hellish glow lit the darkness ahead, the flicker of promethium flames, suffused with occasional flashes of actinic blue. The bulky forms of other greenskins became visible the closer the commandos drew, multiple mobs roaring and bellowing with battle lust, stampeding through the city's wreckage towards some sort of spreading combat.
High ground!
One of the commandos, Lugin, grunted, gesturing to the toppled remains of what had once been one of the Humis' habitation blocks. It stood as a pillar of shattered masonry and twisted girders, jutting out of the rubble a little further north.
Stay here,
Stabskar said to the rest of the mob, and gestured at Grimtooth to follow him. The two commandos sheathed their wicked blades and began to climb the steep mound, hand over hand, scarred green fists gripping the remains of jagged stonework and bent plasteel struts. They scaled the ruins like burly simians, coming to a crouch side by side at the collapsed block's pinnacle. Beneath, to the east, a savage brawl was playing out. Fire lit the night, gouting from the fists of a trio of heavily armed beakies. They were wading into the mobs, charging them like slow-moving machines, surrounding themselves with an expanding wall of blazing heat and leaving a trail of burning, blackened corpses behind. Even more killy-looking was the war machine advancing behind the flamer-armed blue boys. It was a great battle tank, but what immediately drew Stabskar's attention was not its heavy, sloping blue armor plates, or even the dagger blazing from its many weapon sponsons. What made the commando stare was the fact that it was floating. It moved with a heavy, leaden grace, its flanks and rear engines throbbing with some sort of anti-gravitic thrust. Even more impressively, the space beneath its bulk was not simply open and clear. A downward force was crushing everything the tank was moving over, grinding rubble and pulverizing corpses, leaving a trail of completely flattened destruction in its wake.
I'd never seen the Humis using something like that before, Grimtooth said, peering through his spotting tube. Cogcrusher would love to tinker with that,
Stabskar said, thoughtfully, chewing slowly on a scrap of old flesh he'd extracted from between his tusks.
Looks like they've got a boss pole, too, Grimtooth added. What?
Stabskar demanded, grasping the spotting tube from his subordinate. He peered through the grimy lens, past the mobs of torched boys, until he was focused just ahead of the big, hovering tank. There he saw what Grimtooth had spotted. A banner rippling in the fire-licked dust, blue and white, a winged lightning symbol topping it. Even better, there was another beaky warrior beside the one carrying it. His armor was like the three with the burny bits, but instead of fire, he was wreathed in lightning that cracked from one great gauntlet and from the sword shining in his other fist.
Humi, boss boy,
Stabskar growled, tossing the spotter back to Grimtooth.
If he's here, the white one could be close. Let's get down there.
The two orcs clambered back down the Havelock's ruins. They barely rejoined their mob when a fresh bout of roaring swelled from the darkness. Stabskar and Grimtooth exchanged a glance. They knew that sound. Urgork and his boss Nobs had arrived. Demeter. Extremis had spearheaded the Fulminatus counterattack throughout the night. Demeter and the three aggressors of Squad Tyro followed in its crushing wake beneath Skyrus and the silkweave of the Fulminatus Standard. They had continued south from the Basilica until word from Extremis's commander, Techmarine Tiberon, crackled over the Vox. There were contacts ahead. As the repulsor's lascannon spat beams of blue energy into the dust and its heavy bolters began thundering, Demeter and the others moved to secure the grab tank's flanks, keeping their formation tight on the sides of the heavy vehicle. Moments later, as the first greenskins came scrambling over the rubble, Squad Tyro ignited their flame gauntlets. The blaze of promethium kept the Xenos at bay for long, heat-washed minutes, and those aliens that stumbled aflame through the inferno were smashed to bloody wreckage by Demeter's Boltstorm gauntlet or power sword. The Auspects read thousands of contacts, closing from the south, east, and west. Just as Demeter had hoped, the prospect of such a vicious combat, not to mention the presence of the repulsor, was dragging the greenskin assault towards them for miles in every direction.
"All units, continue the withdrawal," the captain voxed.
Communications were getting choppy thanks to the increasing distance between himself and the rest of the Fulminata. Those locator beacons still being transmitted showed squads pulling back to the north and east, bound for Shabbat's outskirts. How many of the guard had already got out was impossible to say, but the flash of combat engagements across the burst map was rolling steadily eastwards from the Gorgon. Only in the south had it stalled, locked around the bastion of Demeter's resistance.
"Anti-armor to the east!"
Brother Tor's voice crackled over the link. The words had barely registered before a battered-looking rocket corkscrewed up through the black smoke and flames, detonating above the repulsor and showering its blue hull with a burst of metal fragments. A second rocket followed almost immediately, slashing just past the tank's prow and away through the smoke.
"Brother Uxis!" Demeter voxed.
The aggressor's icon blinked with an affirmative as the heavily armored Primaris widened the cordon to the east, bringing the orc tank hunters into range of his ever-hungry flamers. The blackened nozzles of the weapons were glowing white-hot now, and the air was almost unbreathably heavy with black smoke and the stench of charred flesh and liquefied organs. The captain's auto-sensors were reading an external heat approaching 1,000 degrees, and even the proud blue heraldry adorning the aggressor's resistant ceramite plates had started to blister and blacken. An orc stumbled through the fire, ablaze from head to foot, howling with fury, even as its lungs choked with fumes. A short, hard slash of Demeter's blade sent its head tumbling from its shoulders, and the rest of its body thumped from his armor, sprawling on the ash-darkened debris underfoot. Skyrus was behind the captain, between him and the repulsor's frontal glacis, the artificial material of the company standard ensuring it didn't combust in the infernal temperatures. The captain felt a sudden fierce upsurge of pride as he half-turned towards the rippling blue and white, the golden lightning bolt of the Fulminata topping the banner. Every minute that it continued to fly preserved more lives. There was no greater purpose the proud standard could serve. As though in answer to his thoughts, a series of bestial howls rose above the pulsing of the repulsor's grav-engines. A glance at his gauntlet's inbuilt auspects told Demeter that a fresh wedge of contacts were approaching rapidly from the south. Shapes came charging through the fire, wreathing the front of the spearhead formation, heedless of the heat that engulfed them. Demeter realized immediately that they were the bodyguard of some powerful greenskin leader. Each was a muscle-clad brute, wielding weapons their lesser kindred would have struggled to lift. The captain's thoughts were confirmed when, seconds later, an even greater shape came charging through the inferno, the earth shuddering beneath it. The captain recognized it immediately from the intelligence dockets and briefing sessions undertaken when they'd first arrived in the Akara war zone. It was Urgork, the freakish lord and master of the Wah, that had brought devastation to the surrounding systems. The aggressor's fires picked out its nightmarish body, the patchwork limbs and jagged stitches that crisscrossed its mostly exposed flesh. It had a great, wicked blade in each fist, and as it burst through the flames, its small, cruel eyes locked with Demeter's visor. It gestured at him with one of its skinning knives and barked something in its alien tongue, as either side its bodyguards threw themselves at the aggressors, choppers and chain axes battering flame-scorched Gravis plate.
"Face me, Xenos!" Demeter snarled, raising his Boltstorm gauntlet. Urgork answered with a grunt. Head down, the hulking alien charged, barging lesser greenskins aside. Amidst the roaring flames and the crackle of raw destructive power, Demeter met it head-on.
Chapter 4. The Ash Wastes. Polixis. Polixis and Squad Domitian linked up with a trio of Zoyshen Leman Russ battle tanks, about half a mile west of Shibat's outskirts. The Zoyshen commander, a captain named Chao Li, had already lost half of his armored company, fighting scattered rearguard actions along the banks of the Gorgon, as greenskin barges and rafts had poured across the sluggish, toxic river. The remaining tanks were accompanied by little more than a single ragged platoon of Voitican infantry, who stared at the Primaris as they emerged from the night, caked in dust and congealed alien blood. "Is there anything left further south of here?" Domitian asked Chao Li, whilst the battered column paused amidst the remains of what had once been the city's main maglev line, now broken and twisted beneath the mass of debris thrown down by the rock's impact. "We're the last," Chao Li said from the cupola of his Lehman Russ Punisher. "I had a demolisher half a mile southeast of us, but I've not heard anything over the Vox for 20 minutes. If he's not already out, he won't be getting out."
"Keep moving," Domitian said. The Hellblasters falling in either side of the tanks as they began to trundle along the maglev line's remains. Severus and his pack of Reavers had already dropped away, disappearing with as little notice as they had first appeared, presumably moving to help extricate another squad from close contact with the Xenos still pouring across the river. Polixis checked the dispersal runes on his visor. Nearly all of the demi-company had progressed east and were nearing Shebat's edge. All except Captain Demeter, his aggressors, and the repulsor Extremis. They remained to the south, utterly surrounded now by icons representing enemy contacts. Every instinct demanded Polixis turn and go to the aid of his captain and brothers. To lose the captain, the company standard, and the likes of Extremis was a dire blow for the Fulminata, but to also lose all of their progenoids as well was almost unconscionable. He tried to focus his mind on the matters that defined him: duty, the willingness to serve and save. He had to follow orders. He had to follow the Codex.
"Without the seed of our warriors, the chapter dies," he reminded himself, voicing one of his apothecary pledges. "But without me, few can extract it. I will put my own duty above all else."
To have stayed at Demeter's side or gone back to him once he was engulfed would have been an outrageous dereliction of his own duties, and a break with numerous salient tenets of the Codex Astartes. Worst of all, it would have rendered the captain's sacrifice in vain. He would not go back. He busied himself with reviewing his charges as he trudged alongside the Zoyshen tanks. According to their readouts, both Trejo and Enyo were suffering, but their vitae had stabilized and the chances of a fatality had now reduced to almost nil. Trejo would have joined Brother Priscor aboard the Spear of Macrag for bionic refit and an intensive period of bonding therapy, but the Xenos fleet now controlling orbital space had denied such a possibility. The crippled Primaris would have no choice other than to remain with the rear echelons once they were eventually re-established. Enyo at least would still be capable of fighting once the crushed remains of his left forearm were amputated. Gilliman knew it looked like the Fulminata would need every Primaris still capable of lifting a bolter soon enough. Eventually, they broke free of Shebat's eastern flank and passed the slums that had been flattened by the rock's blast wave. Dawn light was attempting to break through the pall of dust and ash kicked up by the impact, creating a dull grey tinge that the auto-sensors of the Primaris picked up and amplified. Polixis mounted a final mound of masonry on Shebat's edge as the armor and their weary support squads trudged past, the passage of the tanks making the rubble underfoot vibrate. The apothecary looked east, to where the ash wastes spread out beyond the refinery city, undulating dunes and barren tundra whipped by an eye-stinging, throat-parching wind. The many miles between Shebat and the great, brutalist sprawl of the capital city of Croton would have appeared truly desolate, were it not for the thousands of figures now making their weary way out into the expanse. Polixis watched as the Imperium withdrew from Shebat. The miserable grey light picked out dozens of columns, insubstantial, faceless masses in the half-darkness, winding away from the city's edge. Armored vehicles, tanks, and cargo eights interspersed lines of bent-backed, respirator-clad infantry, moving with the weary tread of those who had just come within inches of a violent death. Company and regimental pennants fluttered in the caustic wind, their ash-caked fabric acting as rallying points for the scattered units that had dragged themselves from the ruined city after command and control had broken down. Less than half a mile away, Polixus's enhanced eyesight picked out the struggles of a labouring Adeptus Mechanicus engine seer and his dead-fleshed servitors as they fought to repair a Lehman Russ that had broken down just off one of the Rock Creek roads leading from the city. Nearby, a Departmento Munitorum flatbed was dispensing water canisters, the quartermaster standing on the back of the trailer bellowing furiously for order at the mob of parched guardsmen that had surrounded the vehicle. The entire expanse before the Primaris was a disorganized, demoralized vista, the personification of defeat. Domitian clambered up onto the runners of Chow Lee's battle tank, the vehicle pausing before it rolled out into the ash wastes. They were consulting the guard officer's pocket chart. Polixus descended from his mound of rubble and rejoined the squad. Trajo had been mounted on the rear of one of the Zoishen tanks, and Polixus applied another salve shot to him via his armor's interface port. The Hellblaster was silent, his mood grim. It looked as though bionics were going to be the only feasible treatment.
"Soon you'll contain so much metal that Helix won't be able to operate on you anymore," Gratian joked gruffly, looking up at his fellow Hellblaster. "Techmarine Tiberon will be the one to oil you. At least it won't be difficult for me to kick you to death when you make more ill jests, brother," Trajo replied from between gritted teeth. Despite himself, Polixus smiled.
"Fifth and Eighth Corps have established a cordon 3 miles further east," Domitian voxed as he dropped back down from the Lehman Russ. "Along a ridgeline past the waste dunes. The tanks will continue following the maglev. There's still no contact with Lieutenant Tyrannus, so we'll do the same and link with the new front once we reach it."
They moved on, joining the rear of a straggling column of Numerians already using the maglev line to move out into the grey expanse beyond the city. Even behind the glassy film of their respirator lenses, Polixus could recognize the looks they gave the towering ultramarines, fear coupled with shame and raw exhaustion. It was easy to forget that even the most experienced soldiers of the Astra Militarum lacked the fortitude of the Adeptus Astartes. In the past 12 hours, these men had successfully driven the Xenos menace from half of Shebat and achieved all their objectives, only for the sky itself to come crashing down on them. Comrades had been crushed and buried alive in their thousands, and an enemy they had thought beaten, at least for one day, had come surging at them once again with renewed ferocity. Now they were retreating, abandoning wounded friends and the streets they had fought and bled for, all reduced to rubble. These men were beaten. They could be rallied, though. Polixus knew that much. He had seen his brother do it enough times to be in no doubt about the resilience of mankind's fighting spirit. He just hoped it could be done before the Greenskins followed up on their victory. The vox clicked, a few words cutting through before the link degenerated into static again. Contact with the rest of the Fulminata had been almost wholly lost, and most of the squads were only appearing occasionally now on the map interface. There was no sign whatsoever of Demeter or the Battle Brothers who had made their stand to the south. Polixus forced their fate from his mind. There was nothing that could be done now. They had to reach the newly established line out in the wastes, then ensure it was capable of receiving the next Greenskin attack when it inevitably came. As the column trudged on, the apothecary glanced back towards Shebat. The ruination that had descended on the city was only just becoming apparent as the day's light spread, and the worst of the dust cloud began to settle. A moonscape of craggy stone, rockcrete, and broken girders stretched away, as desolate and bleak as the ash dunes ahead. In the distance, the Primaris thought he could pick out the defiant spires of the Basilica, still standing tall amidst the destruction. He wondered whether the orcs had reached it yet. Polixus did not put a great deal of stock in battle oaths and pledges of vengeance. He had more vital duties to attend to than matters of personal honour. But in that moment, surrounded by defeat, he swore that he would return and reclaim those distant spires, for the Primarch and the Emperor and all those who had fallen in their defence. Today had been a bloody reckoning. There would be another soon. Castor. The nexus of the new Imperial defensive line east of Shebat Alpha was a long, low ash dune labelled Ridge 1. It had only just acquired the moniker, courtesy of some Departmento cartographic analyst attached to the 8th Corps. Whether the primitive ash waste dwellers had a name for the rise running between the Maglev line and the main highway to Croton, nobody seemed to know. On the Fulminata's strategic displays, it remained a nameless, largely featureless stretch of barren grey soil. By the time Castor reached it, defensive preparations were well underway. Two batteries of Vostroyan mobile artillery from the 8th Corps had been sighted just back from the ridgeline. Basilisks and manticores mostly, interspersed with Hydra anti-aircraft guns. Initially, the guard had attempted to establish trenches along the ridge's length, before quickly realizing that the shifting ash soil would make the task impossible. Instead, sandbags had been filled, and raised redoubts were taking shape, interspersed with battle tanks acting as makeshift strongpoints. The air was filled with the thud and scrape of shovels and the growl of engines as the Ultramarine's chaplain climbed the slope to where the Corps commander's skull pennant was fluttering in the bitter morning breeze. Lieutenant Tyrannus was at Castor's side. The Fulminata's second-in-command had assumed leadership of the demi-company since contact had been lost with Demeter. He had spoken little to Castor since the chaplain had linked up with him just east of the Basilica. He could sense the lieutenant's thoughts were the same as his. Both seethed over the defeat they had suffered. Multiple times during the withdrawal from Shebat, it was all Castor could do not to turn on his heel and stride after Captain Demeter. Each time he had reminded himself that the role of the chaplain was not only one of fiery vengeance. He was a guide, an exemplar for all his brethren, and to be seen to abandon reason and go against direct orders in the name of zealous fervour was a sin against the Codex that he refused to commit. They climbed Ridge 1. All the Fulminata squads had reached Imperial lines, though most had done so further north. It would take time to gather them all once more. Ahead of Castor, amid a sandbag redoubt being slowly assembled by labouring ash-caked Kelistan stormers, lay the forward command post of Major General Chevik. It was a prefabricated envirodome, reinforced by flakboard and sandbags, and studded with Vox uplink masts. The respirator mast Tempest Scions, standing guard at the main entrance, didn't try to stop the two Ultramarines as they ducked inside. Within, they discovered a cramped space housing little more than a camp desk littered with charts and data slates, and a bulky Vox system, wired up to a wall formed at the rear of the dome by a row of Departmento-stamped flakboards. General Chevik himself was standing to one side, an aide helping him out of his heavy, brocaded red uniform, while another vainly tried to dust the cloying grey ash from the thick fur of his tall papaka hat. The commander of the 8th Corps was a short, bluff figure, typical of the guard regiments of Vostroya. His heavy grey moustache was impeccably waxed and curled, and a jagged scar running down the left side of his face caused one eyelid to droop lower than the other. The aides continued to try dusting ash from the fine lace and furred collar of the general's uniform, while Chevik, now in his shirt sleeves and boots, made the sign of the Aquila towards the two Primaris.
"My lords," he said,
flinty eyes taking in the towering armoured warriors without any hint of trepidation.
"Welcome to 8th Corps Command. How can I be of service?"
"Our thanks, Major General,"
Tyrannus said, mirroring the guardsman's salute.
"We have come here directly from Shebat. We no longer have contact with Captain Demeter, so I have assumed leadership of the Fulminata for the time being."
"Then my men and I are at your disposal, Lord,"
Chevik said, inclining his head slightly.
"You have received word from Field Marshal Kloss?"
"Not since I was ordered to establish a new defensive line here. From what I can gather, the Field Marshal is with 5th Corps, 6 miles to the north."
"Show me your dispositions,"
Tyrannus ordered, moving to the chart-littered camp table. Castor remained near the post's self-sealing entrance flap as the lieutenant discussed the strength and location of Chevik's 16 divisions. In truth, the chaplain's mind was elsewhere. Severus had reported back to him in person. His brother lived. He had already given silent thanks for such a blessing. To have lost the captain and ancient alongside the repulsor and the Fulminatus standard was a grievous blow. To have also lost the strike force's only apothecary would have spelled disaster. Castor did not feel the need to further rationalize his orders to the Reavers. Polixis would no doubt be angry with him. If there was one particular fault they both shared, it was the fact that neither found it easy admitting when they needed help, least of all from the other. It had been the same ever since they were children, not that Polixis remembered much of their lives pre-induction. The privilege of being haunted by those memories seemed to have been reserved for Castor only. He watched as Tyrannus listened to Chevik's reports about the situation of the new front. The lieutenant had maglocked his helm, and his expression was open and engaged. Like Demeter, interacting with others seemed to come naturally to him. He had consciously moulded himself in the captain's image, striving to achieve the ideals of the Codex, a rounded warrior strategist, with an eye for the diplomacy required whenever the disparate wings of the Imperium's armed forces fought side by side. Objectively, the Fulminata couldn't have found itself with a better commander. That didn't ease their loss, though.
"We're still receiving columns from Shebat," Chevik was saying, indicating 3 points along the ridgeline displayed on one of the maps. "Mostly elements of the 1st and 3rd Corps. Organization is minimal. We're admitting them through our lines here, here, and here. The rear echelons have been opened up, and they're being regrouped. Major General Hunley is still in command of the 3rd. 1st is under the acting command of Commissar General Vrenk." "Are both corps still combat capable?" Tyrannus asked.
"You are with them, my lord. You probably know better than I do. The collapse of so much of the city and the chaos of the retreat has left some units at less than 50% of their starting strength. How many of those reported missing will straggle in over the next few days is impossible to say. There seem to be a great deal of walking wounded, too. Again, courtesy of the city's collapse. My corps aid stations are already overburdened, and we're working to establish better triage all across the line."
"If the Greenskins mount a concerted attack across the line within the next few hours, we will not be able to resist them," Tyrannus said, simply. It looked as though Chevik was going to argue, his Vostroian pride stung. Eventually, though, he nodded.
"I cannot deny that. Not only would the line collapse, but any breach would likely see the whole front overrun. I doubt those units still regrouping to our rear would hold for long. We are not ready."
"Then it is my duty to make you ready," Tyrannus said. He turned towards Custer.
"I will need a transport," the chaplain said, before the lieutenant had spoken. "You may have my personal command, Chimera," Chevik said. "Its Vox system should help you coordinate more closely with the commanders on the ground."
"I will dispatch Sergeants Clastus and Nerva to the corps immediately north and south of us," Tyrannus added. "With the Emperor's blessings, we will be ready by nightfall."
"May his light go with you, Brother Lieutenant," Custer said. "And with you, General Chevik. I will return as soon as I am able."
He made the sign of the Aquila and pushed out through the Envirodome's flap. Outside, the wind was rising, whipping up an ash cloud to further clog an atmosphere already choked with the dust of the rock's fallout. Though midday was fast approaching, the world seemed locked in a perpetual twilight, the figures laboring at the sandbag redoubts below Castor reduced to indistinct, bent-over spectres in the grey gloom. Though he'd been outside for mere seconds, already ash was starting to heap around his boots and cake his vestments. There was a sudden supersonic bang reverberating like a thunderclap across the ridgeline. Custer looked skywards, but even his skull helm's lenses were unable to pick out whatever had passed overhead through the dust storm. It seemed hard to believe that any aircraft could be aloft in such conditions, but nor did he find the idea of green-skinned pilots braving the choked atmosphere hard to believe. Once the worst of the ash settled, the Orc's crewed air fleet would surely descend on the Imperial positions en masse. As long as the aliens controlled orbit, they controlled the skies. Instinct told Castor that the fighting in Shabbat had only been a prelude, that there was more slaughter to come. He hoped he was right. The Xenos scum were crying out for vengeance, and he would deliver it. Stabscar. The commandos were the first greenskins to reach the Humi shrine place. Under Stabscar's directives, they approached cautiously, using the flanks of the square laid out before the looming structure. There was no movement from up ahead. The ruins stretched away in the grey half-light, and the Humi corpses and wrecks that littered the square remained motionless. Stabscar signalled for the point boys to move in through the great building's front doors, peering after them as they disappeared into the darkness beyond. His gut told him the Humis were long gone. He'd never heard of them abandoning big, fancy, spiky buildings like the one in front of him without a fight, unless they decided to leg it. He hadn't reached his current rank, however, by taking unnecessary risks. That was what the footsloggers were for. After a few tense moments, one of the commandos re-emerged on the building's entrance steps and waved the thumb and little finger of one hand above his head. All clear.
"Move, Gitz,"
Stabscar grunted at the rest of the mob, iron-shod boots cracking off the stone steps as they hustled up and into the great building. Beyond the doors, the commando boss found himself in an echoing, vaulted space that rose on thick stone pillars and swooped overhead in a series of vast arches. He had seen such structures on several previous occasions. They always made for good looting. He'd never understood why the Humis spent such time and effort building them, much less why they then packed such wastes of space with all sorts of shiny gubbins. But what mattered most of all was that they usually gave a good scrap trying to defend them.
"Where's all the Humis, then?"
one of the commandos, Grit, demanded sullenly. Stabscar didn't deign to answer, but it was a struggle not to show his own disappointment. Taking one of these buildings without a fight felt wrong. Zorg, the commando boss, snapped at the smallest, runtiest greenskin in the mob.
"Get moving and find a war boss. Tell him the Humis is definitely gone and we've got their big spiky place."
As Zorg scampered off, Stabscar drew his ragged camo cape around him and sat heavily on one of the carved wooden benches occupying the building's open floor, the timber groaning beneath his weight. If nothing else, he hoped taking the vast structure would make Urgork forget about the fact that his commandos had failed to find the Beaky in the white armor. Polixis. The Voitican on the operating table was unconscious again. Polixis watched the orderlies working over him, marveling at their struggles. To see the difficulty human medicates had in keeping their patients stable always led Polixis to reflect on the blessings of Adeptus Astartes' physiology. Here, men screamed. They lost control of their bowels. They flatlined. They bled out, and the apothecary had been forced to remind himself that a normal mortal's wounds didn't clot within seconds of their own accord. Men looked to their battlefield exploits to claim that space marines were a long step removed from humanity, demigods of war, but the differences were even more apparent here, beneath the harsh surgery lumens, amidst the blood and the sweat and the screaming and the thump of bone saws and slitting of scalpels. He dragged himself from his thoughts and turned away from the operation he'd been watching, heading instead for the Medicaid dome's entrance. The large space was packed with the wounded and the dying, and stank of counterseptics and blood. Most of the injuries were fractures, breaks, and crush wounds, all related to the sudden collapse of so much of Shebat's infrastructure when the rock had struck. Many of the guardsmen confined to the ward had been carried in the arms of their exhausted squadmates, or had limped in themselves. The staff, the rear echelon medical contingent of the 8th Corps, had barely set up that morning before the casualties began flooding in. They were wholly out of splints and were running short of plaster wraps and castor braces. And this was only one of the larger casualty wards. Polixis had parted ways with Squad Domitian at one of the forward triage stations near the base of Ridge 1's reverse slope. It was nothing more than a large, open-sided tent with some jury-rigged tarps keeping the worst of the ash storm at bay. Medicays and corpsmen were working in their respirators, and simply keeping wounds clean was nigh on an impossibility. Body bags were stacking up outside, many almost submerged in the drifting pall of ash that befouled everything in the wastes. Polixis had operated on Treasure with what little equipment he had to hand. When he'd arrived at the facility, a separate compartment outside the main ward featured hoses and decontamination units for those entering the sterile environment beyond. Polixis had begrudgingly permitted the servitors to remove the worst of the battle grime from his white plate, but a far more thorough job and the correct benedictions to the armor's venerable spirit would be required before it was free of the day's bitter legacy. As he stepped out through the sealant flaps and back into the wind and ash, he tried to quell the frustration that still simmered at the back of his mind. He had seen enough of the galaxy and its horrors to know just how badly mismatched individual servants of the Imperium were against their foes. The reality of mankind's struggle was something he knew he would never be comfortable obscuring. It was difficult to give hope when there was so little to go around. Ironically, it was his brother whose words could uplift. Polixis had seen him bring purpose and resolve to planetary governors and Underhive Savlar militia alike. To him, the words he spoke were not lies or manipulative half-truths. They were the fuel that kept the candle in the dark aflame, that stopped the light that gave humanity hope from guttering out. And Polixis couldn't deny that hope was their surest weapon, especially in times such as these. He turned to follow the eastern flank of the ridge, towards the rally coordinates newly uploaded by Lieutenant Tyrannus. The Fulminata were to regroup at 8th Corps headquarters, near the center of the ridgeline. From there, they would oversee the preparation of the new defensive positions. At best, they would be largely completed by the time the Greenskins coordinated their inevitable offensive. At worst, the Fulminata would be the only one standing between the rampant Xenos and the complete collapse of Imperial forces west of Croton. Castor. Castor moved among the Imperial Guard like a vision of death. Men cringed away, gasped, even cried out as he passed by. The barked commands of officers and sergeants died on the wind as the spectre materialized from the ash and dust, the storm snatching at his vestments and the cowl that shrouded his nightmarish skull. The wounded were the most afraid, for some no doubt believed he had come for their souls. They clutched Aquila tokens and lucky charms and turned their eyes away, not daring to breathe through their respirators lest the rattling inhalation drew the glowering red gaze of the phantom. Castor strode the eastern slope of the ridgeline amidst those guard units newly arrived from Shabbat. He spoke to some, and it was always the same message, a single word, follow. And follow they did, some out of fear, some out of awe, some because of the hope that, when their time came, the reaping spectre would remember them kindly. They followed, moving from the clogged trails being used by the other retreating columns towards shallower paths, almost lost amidst the ever-shifting wasteland. They went together, disparate men and women from the far corners of the galaxy, Voitikans and Calistani, Faban vanquishers and Vostroyans, flame troopers from Pyre and marksmen from the snow forests of Lorik, first united under the Aquila and now again in the long shadow of the great grim figure who had led them through the wind and ash. Castor took them to the tribal rock that jutted close to the northern extent of Ridge 1. It was a gathering place for the nomadic scavenger peoples that inhabited the ash wastes, evidenced by the totemic remains heaped around the base of the stony protrusion. The dust-caked skulls of great ash fangs and greymores, and all manner of rusting detritus and trinkets, heaped the sides of the jagged outcrop. Amongst the litter, the Astra Militarum gathered, hundreds of respirator-clad faces staring upwards in silence. The chaplain climbed the flank of the ridge and then turned along the top of the outcrop, his heavy boots grating slowly on stone. The wind was even stronger on top of the rock, making his robes and purity parchments flutter and snap. He drew back his cowl, revealing the full morbidity of his skull helm. Below, the human soldiers of the Imperium waited, more straggling in by the minute, drawn by the single, rasped command of the black-armored giant. The chaplain of the Fulminata raised Salve Imperata in one fist, slowly. Deactivated, the skull mace gleamed coldly in the gray light, its empty eye sockets seeming to glare down at the weary, ash-covered congregation. Castor held the weapon before them in silence, before he finally spoke.
"We have all failed," he said. "We have all fallen short of the devotion our Emperor requires of us."
The words were not delivered loudly or forcefully, only amplified enough by his helmet's vox unit to carry over the worst of the wind. It brought a murmur back to him, the half-voiced disbelief of those whose denial was finally coming undone.
"A day that started in glorious victory was seen out in the totality of abject defeat," he went on.
The murmurs rose.
"Perhaps your officers have told you otherwise. Perhaps they have sought out hope in what has befallen us. A tactical withdrawal and mass redeployment. That is to their credit, for it is their duty to maintain your resolve. But be under no illusions here, soldiers of the Emperor. We have failed him. Amid that defeat, who here has not lost a brother or squadmate? In among a city brought to ruination, who has not abandoned brethren trapped and crushed by the weight of Shebat's destruction?"
Someone shouted from the assembly, the words lost, but the anger clear.
"You are not alone,"
Castor said, still holding up his Crozius Arcanum.
"I am condemned with you, I and all my brothers. We too have failed. We too have been driven out by Xenos filth, cast into the wilderness by beasts that have no right to share this galaxy with us. Some of you will even have witnessed my brother's fall, brought low by the savagery of the green-skin menace. Yes, for we are not immortal on the field of battle. We die also, and the Ultramarines chapter has suffered a grievous blow amidst the ruins of Shebat."
There were more shouts, a swell of shock and outrage among the huddled congregation, rising like a tide over the fear the guardsmen felt towards the towering Primaris.
"This loss is no easy thing to take," Castor went on, voice amplified above their protestations. "Failures like these haunt the memory and breed doubt and fear among those not staunch in mind and soul. And yet, my brothers, and yet..."
The murmuring below trailed off as the guardsmen waited on the chaplain's words.
"Yet there is a strength in such a defeat, for the few who have the courage to find it. There is an awakening, new resolve, new understanding, a purpose that is clearer and firmer than what came before. Not all rally to it, not everyone stands again after they are struck down. But I do, and by your presence here, I know that you do, too."
This time, there was only silence. The chaplain's voice continued to rise, reverberating now through the ash storm, base and unyielding as iron.
"We were defeated yesterday, but we were not broken. We failed, but we have not been destroyed. We are still standing, every one of us. And if we stand, we can fight. And if we can fight, we can win. Avenge our losses, wipe away the stain of our failure, and reclaim this world!"
for Wojtek and the Emperor!
Came a shout from someone close to the front of the assembly.
For Shivat and Ikara!
Added another. The voices in the crowd returned, rising no longer in dismay, but in pride and defiance.
The Xenos will come again,
Castor boomed.
But this time, when they do, we will be ready. This time, we will meet their savagery, and we will break them with Lasgun and with bayonet.
The crowd began to cheer. Castor continued.
Do not be dismayed by their violence or their numbers. Stand by your squadmates. Listen to the orders of your commanding officers. And above all, remember that you are soldiers of the God Emperor's Astra Militarum, the defenders of humanity, and the vanquishers of its darkest foes. No failure, no defeat. After today, we will know only victory. For the Emperor!
The final words were punctuated by the activation of Salve Imperata. Lightning surged up the mace and crackled about its skull tip, a sudden, searing affirmation that the chaplain's words were not mere oration. The cheering went on for long minutes, during which Castor privately narrated the 17th admonishment in his own head, a penitence canticle that reminded its reciter that their only worth was in their service to the Emperor and the chapter. The cheers of men had turned many of the Emperor's chosen from the path of righteousness before. Afterwards, he led the assembly in the singing of Imperator Gloriam, that old guard battle hymnal. In the meantime, fresh runners had arrived for the units Castor had gathered, bearing deployment and disposition dockets. The congregation started to disperse, moving now with less weariness and more purpose. Officers barked orders, and men rallied to platoon and company standards that streamed in the ash-heavy wind. Columns began to set off as their new orders were checked and confirmed. The pause had put steel and vigour into what had previously been a mass of tired, confused, and directionless men and women. Only one figure remained, formerly hidden amongst the crowds near the base of the rock, close to the old rubbish heaped up by the waste's tribespeople. Castor descended from his promontory and paced through the rusting detritus to where his brother stood and waited.
"Why here?" Polixis asked him.
"Because I can be seen,"
Castor replied, gesturing towards the rock,
"and because it pulls units away from the congestion on the main tracks. Moving them here means they can disperse more effectively, especially with the storm slowing everything down."
"Practicality, as well as fervor," Polixis said. "You do the chapter honor, as ever."
For a moment, neither Primaris spoke. Castor offered his arm. After the briefest hesitation, Polixis took it in the warrior's grip.
"It's good to see you once again, brother,"
Castor said.
"And to see you," Polixis said. "I thank the Emperor that you left Shebat unharmed."
"I felt the hand of him on us both. Likewise with Squad Domitian. Brothers Trajo and Ennio will fight again?"
"They will, though Trajo not for some time. I shall visit him as soon as my duties allow. Knowing him, he will rail against anything that sees him removed from the front line, no matter how grievous the wounds. The Emperor knows we will need every battle brother soon enough."
There was silence between the two of them before Polixis spoke once more, and this time there was iron in his voice, as unyielding as Castor's when his words to the guard had reached their crescendo.
"You sent the Reavers to see me safely out of Shabbat, didn't you?"
"I did,"
Castor said, without any hint of hesitation.
"The Fulminatus suffered enough last night. I could not countenance the loss of its apothecary, as well as its captain, Ancient, and all those battle brothers who perished fighting to give the Astra Militarum time.
Lieutenant Tyrannus approved the deployment of Severus and his brethren. He could have been elsewhere. He could have been securing the captain. Captain Demeter's orders were in no way uncertain. He wished to draw as many Xenos to himself for as long as possible. He did not intend to leave Shibat.
I hope you at least counseled him otherwise, Polixis said.
Of course I did,
Custer replied, fire now in his own voice.
What would you have had me do? Disobey his orders? Go after him? Bring the rest of the Fulminata to his side? You know that what he did was perfectly within the bounds of the Codex, and more importantly, it saved lives. The defenses on this ridge would not be enough without the evacuation of so many men from the city. He has given us a chance to stem the Xenos here when they come.
You think these men who heard you today will stand when the Greenskins come again? You cannot be everywhere at once, Custer. What will your congregation say now that they disperse? Will enough men take heart from the stories that spread from your words?
They will say they saw one of the God Emperor's chosen,
Custer replied simply.
And that doesn't bother you?
Should it?
Are we the Emperor's chosen, brother? I have certainly never found any particular divine spark to us, not when I have studied the physiology of our kind. There is no noble grace when I saw off limbs and suture flesh and try to restart twin hearts. We are brute meat, my brother, changed beyond recognition to fulfill a single purpose, the role of the warrior. We are no different from the vat-grown of Mars, or any machine that is crafted and optimized to fulfill a single, specific purpose. We are certainly no more divine than those men around us. In fact, perhaps we are less so. Do you not teach that mankind's glory is in the very nature of its humanity? As a Medicae, I would hesitate to call either of us human. Not anymore.
You are angry,
Custer said, his voice growing quiet.
And that makes you churlish, brother. I will forget what you are saying here, for both our sakes.
You think I am saying this only to annoy you, little brother? You think me so petty.
I think you normally have a clearer mind than I, Polixis. I invite you to use that mind to question where these words are coming from. Turn your thoughts inwards and consider that it is this past day's pain and loss that is speaking, not you.
Polixis drew in a deep breath rather than reply, and forced himself to consider the chaplain's counsel. A part of him already knew Custer was right. Another part wanted to refuse that realization. He wondered how often they had done this as children, arrayed in frustrated opposition to one another.
The loss of the brother captain has affected me, Polixis admitted, speaking slowly now, as the anger drained from him little by little. The loss of all the battle brothers on this campaign has been a hard burden to bear. You know that none of them sit quietly with me. I have sought to better honor my role as this company's apothecary by distancing myself. But even after all this time,
he trailed off. Castor picked up the words.
You would not be a better apothecary if you did manage to distance yourself from those under your charge. That much I can assure you. Your very nature is what has led you to this role. It is a blessing and a curse. A curse because you feel each and every loss so acutely, but a blessing because you will never stop striving to help those in need. Your role is the hardest of anyone in the Brotherhood. We are all warriors. As you say, we have been bred for it. Yet you alone are expected to set aside the mindset of a trained killer to help and to heal. It is your protective nature that allows you to do that. Never feel the need to quash that. If you felt nothing for our fallen, I would be far more concerned.
Polixis nodded.
My thanks, brother. I had to say that. You are not alone, Castor replied. Do not forget that. We all feel the past day's losses. It is to be expected. Each of the fallen was an exemplar of the chapter. It is my duty to ensure that we all continue without surrendering to darker passions, bitterness, guilt, unchanneled rage.
I do not envy you your position, Brother Chaplain, Polixis said, offering his arm once more.
Nor I yours, Brother Apothecary, Castor answered, taking him by the vambrace. The Xenos will come again, and soon, I fear. When they do, go with care. I was speaking the truth when I said we cannot afford to lose you now as well.
I would demand the same of you, Polixis said, but I know I will find you wherever the fighting is hardest.
We all do the Emperor's will, one way or another, Castor replied,
and Polixis had known him long enough to be certain that there was a smile playing out behind the death grin of his skull helm.
I will see you again soon, brother.
Urgork. Urgork looked around at the vaults and statues that constituted the Humi's shrine thing. Cogcrusher had told him they called such a place a cathedral. Supposedly, it was the place where their big boss watched over them. There was no sign of him now, though, much to Urgork's chagrin. No Humi's at all, in fact. They'd all run, like the weak, pink little runties they were. The war boss was standing with one boot on the side of the overturned stone slab that had formerly held pride of place in the echoing chamber. Beneath him, the mobs were already busy turning the structure into a place worthy of their war boss's presence. The statues were being hauled down and smashed, and the walls and pillars were being daubed with blood and dung. Nob Scavitt's lads were erecting a great orc skulldliff over the shattered windows at the rear of the chamber. Mork only knew where they'd scavenged it from. Most important of all were Urgork's own trophies. The stone slab was being refashioned by Cogcrusher and his tinkerers, the arching ceiling above resounding to the noise of chisel drills and welding hammers as they drove spikes and staves into the defiled white stone, fashioning a new throne for Urgork. Already, the great red-daubed squig-hide of his personal banner had been draped above it, and his trophy rack had been laid out before it. The dead eyes and empty sockets of the war boss's vanquished challengers afforded a fine view of the greenskin occupation of the great building. Even more important were the latest additions to Urgork's spoils. The blue beakies had fought long and hard, whole mobs had been immolated by their blazing fires, and Urgork's own body still ached from the wounds he had suffered at the hands of their boss. If his own knob bodyguards hadn't outnumbered the beakies by so much, the fight may have even gone against the war boss. In the end, though, it was the big beaky lying dead, and not the other way around. The corpses of the defiant warriors, each as big and tough as the largest of Urgork's mob leaders, had been dragged to the warlord's new lair, their blue armor caked in dust and blood, and defiled by markings carved in by their killers. Urgork was still deciding what to do with them, but for now they made a fine display at the foot of his new throne. He'd also ordered part of the cathedral's wall to be demolished to make room for the huge tank the Humis had been using. The machine bits that had allowed it to float seemed to have failed, but some makeshift runners fashioned from girders dragged from the city ruins, combined with the exertions of a trio of orc death dreads, had hauled the thing through the rubble all the way to Urgork's headquarters. The warlord had told Cogcrusher in no uncertain terms that he had to complete the new throne before he would be permitted to lay hands upon the captured war machine. He could practically feel the big mech's excitement buzzing in the air around him.
"Boss!"
Urgork grunted, tearing his eyes away from the stone slab and the welder-masked grots labouring around it. Stabskar had approached unnoticed, as he so often did. The commando's second-in-command, Grimtooth, was hovering close behind him, eyes darting between the warlord and his more immediate boss.
"You wanted me, boss,"
Stabskar went on. He was trying to act unconcerned, but Urgork could smell the fear on him, like the stink of grot piss.
"Stabskar!"
the war boss growled, straightening up to his full height so that he loomed over the two commandos.
"You done good securing this place. It's gonna be the headquarters till the last Yumi's outside the city has been crumped."
"That..."
Stabskar began, but Urgork carried on over him.
"I didn't tell you to find this place, though, did I, Stabber?"
Again, Stabskar tried to speak, and again Urgork continued without listening.
"What did I tell you to find, Stabber? Tell me what I sent you after."
Stabskar went silent, his eyes now on his spiked boots.
"The Beaky, boss,"
he said quietly.
"Which Beaky, Stabber?"
"The Beaky in white, boss. You wanted the Beaky in white bits."
"Exactly,"
Urgork said, smacking one hand down on Stabskar's shoulder, making the commando grunt.
"Exactly, Stabber! I gots me plenty of Beakies in the end."
He paused to gesture expansively at the mound of corpses dumped at the base of his slowly forming throne.
"But what colour is they all, Stabber?"
Stabskar hesitated, choking on his words as he tried to avoid the obvious.
"Oh, look!"
Urgork said, taking his hand off the orc's shoulder and bending to drag one claw through the dust and blood caking one of the Humi's armor, leaving a clear trail. He turned sharply back and bellowed in Stabskar's face, a wad of phlegm splattering the stunned greenskin.
"They's blue, Stabber! All of them. No whitens."
"We looked, boss,"
Stabskar managed, cringing back.
"And you found him, didn't you?"
Urgork demanded. Stabskar had no reply, and the bigger orc went on.
"You found him, and you let him leg it. Yeah, I was told all about that."
Stabskar turned towards Grimtooth, still lurking behind him, sudden anger replacing the fear in his eyes. Urgork snatched him again before he could fully round on his subordinate and dragged him in close.
"I gave you one job," the war boss snarled. "So now you gets the reward coming to you. Doc!"
The final word echoed through the vaulted chamber. It was followed by a scampering noise as Grok emerged from behind the apse, hauling his squig satchel full of saw blades and needles.
"My injection, Doc!"
Urgork demanded, holding out one hand while keeping Stabskar clamped in the other. The commando began to struggle, but it was too late. Without pause, Urgork snatched the heavy syringe Grok offered and plunged it into Stabskar's thick neck. Grinning darkly, the war boss jabbed the plunger down. The effect was instantaneous. Stabskar gasped and choked, both hands gripping Urgork's arm as his eyes began to bulge. A mewling noise escaped his throat, and foam started bubbling from between his tusks. Urgork released him and pushed him towards the steps of the raised stone slab. The commando fell to his knees on the edge, hands now clutching his throat, and released a great heaving explosion of vomit. It hit the steps and the flagstones below, making the nearest orcs beneath push and shove one another to avoid it. The bile darkened rapidly, and the lumps floating in it thickened. Stabskar's eyes were wide with agony as he continued to throw up parts of his liquidating internal organs, blood and mulched stomach following pieces of lung and his intestines. He voided his bowels as well, and the flood from his maw lessened abruptly as his throat gave way beneath the acidic flow, disintegrating and drenching his chest. Finally, the greenskin collapsed forwards, rolling down the stairs, covering himself in his own dissolved innards. He came to a stop at the bottom, face down in the steaming, slowly spreading slurry, twitching as the syringe's contents ate away the last of his guts. Silence reigned. Every greenskin in the chamber had stopped and was staring at Stabskar's corpse as it slowly became still.
"Can't take his medicine,"
Urgork grunted, smacking the empty syringe back into Grok's satchel and shoving the pain boy away. The warboss glared at the mass of orcs below and kicked a boot against the corpse of one of the blue beakies, the clatter making everyone jump.
"Who said you could stop working, ya gits?"
he demanded. The orcs hurried to look busy again as Urgork turned towards Grimtooth. The commando had been trying to slink away unnoticed, but froze under Urgork's gaze.
"Got somewhere better to be?" the warboss demanded.
No, boss,
Grimtooth replied, shaking his head vigorously. Urgork grunted and moved down the steps to the side of Stabskar's corpse, boots splashing in the foul, steaming patina that had drenched the flagstones. He yanked the orc's soiled camo cape from the body and tossed it to Grimtooth, who caught it with a grimace. He then gripped Stabskar's remains by the scruff of the neck and dragged him back up the stairs, through his own fluids, until he was slumped over the stone slab. Urgork waved Cogcrusher and his grot workers away with one hand, drawing one of his skinning blades with the other.
"This is a good way to break the new boss chair in, ain't it?"
he asked Grimtooth. The commando simply nodded, dripping cape in one fist, staring as the warboss plunged the blade into the flank of his erstwhile boss and began slowly peeling back a layer of tough green hide.
"You is the boss of Stabber's mob now, Grim,"
Urgork went on, working his blade slowly and methodically just beneath Stabskar's flesh, stripping it away little by little as he flensed the torso back to oozing, part-liquefied muscle.
"Yes, boss,"
Grimtooth said quietly, watching with horrified fascination as the warboss worked.
"Same orders,"
Urgork said, not taking his eye from his blade's progress.
"Find the white beaky. Bring him here, alive. Reckon you can do that?"
"Yes, boss,"
Grimtooth said again.
"Send out Grots,"
Urgork said, gripping a section of flesh with his free hand and dragging it back. Blood and jellied matter was drenching the white stone slab beneath Stabskar's now ragged corpse, running down to pool beneath the mound of beaky dead piled before it.
"Use your sneaky lads. You know 'em. I'm sending Zograk to attack the humies outside the city tonight. Go in with his lads and get me that zogging beaky. If you don't, don't come back."
"Gotcha, boss,"
Grimtooth said, still staring at the gruesome work. Urgork half turned the corpse over, continuing to slide his long blade with a short, firm skimming motion. The warboss paused and looked up, glaring at the remaining commando.
"You still here?"
Grimtooth turned and left hastily, boots splashing in Stabskar's effluvium, as the great skaldliff being erected by Skabit's mob finally thumped into place. Grimtooth. Outside the warboss's new lair, more greenskins were gathering, filling the ruined square with raucous tribal chants and the growling, revving engines of the war trucks that now choked what remained of the adjacent streets. The rest of the commandos were crouched on the steps close to the big, spiky building's broken-down entrance, and they gathered around Grimtooth as he stepped out.
"Where's the boss?"
Krulkill asked.
"Dead,"
Grimtooth said, baring his tusks.
"He failed the big boss too many times. I'm in charge of this here mob now. Big boss's orders. Any git what complains can take it up with him, right once he's done making a new banner from Stabber's hide."
There was no response from the assembled greenskins. Grimtooth looked at each in turn, but none met his gaze. Even without knowing the exact details of what had happened to Stabskar, the threat of Urgork's displeasure was enough. He wrung the stinking bile from the former boss's ragged cape, and with all due ceremony, draped it over his own shoulders before speaking again.
"Same job as before. He wants the white beaky boy. This time we're gonna get it done. I ain't ending up like Stabber."
"How are we finding him, though, boss?"
Ergin asked.
"All the Humies are gone. He could be anywhere by now."
"Humies is just to the east," Grimtooth said. "We'll send out the Gruts. Dorkin and Krulkill, you make sure they do it right. All these lads are headed for a scrap tonight."
He gestured at the mobs filling the square. More were still pouring in, drawn to the new seat of power now established by their war boss. They'd won a great victory the day before, and now they were hungry for more. Grimtooth could feel the power of the Wah suffusing the very air around him, making it practically crackle with energy. The sound and fury of so many good lads gathered together made the very stones of the ruined city vibrate. The urge to get stuck in was almost overwhelming. They were commandos, though. They played it cleverer than the footsloggers.
"We'll go in under the cover of the assault," he went on. "Probably be dark, too, so that'll help. Once the Grots have him fixed, we're in and out sharpish. Big Boss wants to get alive, so no mistakes. Always all squig food. Stick close and keep a good eye out. Got it?"
The rest of the mob grunted their affirmation. Grimtooth turned his gaze back to the mobs below, as the chanting and bellowing reached a bestial, heart-pounding crescendo. Despite himself, he realized he was grinning. One way or another, they were headed for a right good scrap.
Chapter 5. The Battle of Ridge 1. Hanlon. Darkness was falling, and with it, the storm had died. Lieutenant Hanlon shifted the focus ring on the bulky Munitorum issue magnoculars she carried, zooming in on a shallow depression in the ash dunes directly ahead of her position. Something was moving out in the gathering dusk, a black mark on the featureless grey ashscape. The Nomarian pressed her combeads transmission stud.
"Possible contact, 12 o'clock, 1,000 yards out. Stand by."
The rest of the six-man reconnaissance team acknowledged with silent double taps of their bead mics. Hanlon shifted slightly, her body pressed against the warm, dry earth, settling her grip on the magnoculars. They'd been in position for 3 hours Terran standard, ever since relieving the last of the day's pickets, a platoon of Faeburn vanquishers. The six Nomarians were flat to the earth and spaced out over 100 yards, capes draped over their bodies and doused with liberal amounts of the ash surrounding them. In the lengthening shadows and dust-hazed air, they were almost totally indistinguishable from the ground they occupied. They'd had over 12 minor contacts already, all of them small, wiry, green-skinned slave creatures scurrying through the wasteland ahead. Sergeant Rakin, Hanlon's second, thought they were just scavengers come from the city, but Hanlon suspected their presence was more sinister. To her, their activities looked like the work of spotters or scouts. She shifted the magnoculars back over the zone where she'd spotted movement, seeking out a hard fix. Behind her, a sound like a thunderclap rang out, followed by 2 more. A series of distant thudding noises followed, and light flared briefly across the wasteland. She didn't look back. She knew she was hearing the sound of aircraft and the detonation of their bombs along the ridgeline to the recon unit's rear. The moment the worst of the ash storm had lifted, the dust-choked heavens had filled with crude orc planes. Hanlon had heard rumors that the Navy had abandoned Ikara's orbit to a Xenos armada, and half of the aircraft that should have been denying the Greenskins air superiority were still in the launch bays of void warships now on the other side of the system. All of which was why Hanlon had been relieved when Colonel Ruthers had assigned the recon company to picket duty. Even if it took them closer to the alien horde that had stormed Shibat, at least they were no longer stationed on Ridge 1 while the bombs rained down. The aerial attacks were little more than a distraction down among the scrap and ash that stretched out between the ridge and the edge of Shibat's ruined slums. The Gretchen were an altogether more immediate problem. She caught sight of the thing she'd seen earlier, thanks to the magnocular's light-amplifying filter. It was diminutive and hunched over as it scurried from one rock to the next. It also appeared to be carrying something. Hanlon was sure she caught the glimmer of a lens. She cursed softly. They were definitely scouts.
"Contact confirmed," she murmured into the combead. "Markle!"
"Target acquired," the sharpshooter responded over the link.
"Take the shot."
A crack echoed out over the ash. Hanlon saw the greenskin runt twist as it ran, a puff of blood and viscera, curiously devoid of sound at such a distance, flashing across the lieutenant's view before the thing went down. It didn't move again.
"Target eliminated," Hanlon breathed. "Good shot, Max."
"Notch another one up, Vaughn," Markle murmured in response.
Hanlon felt Vaughn, the squad's other marksman, bristle. They were both armed with Mark 7 Zestran long rifles, hard round, silenced. Both had turned the picket duty into an unofficial competition over who could pick off more of the little hook-nosed aliens.
"More ammunition expended per kill shot," Vaughn grumbled. "I could take out a dozen green runs as well if I blew through 5 magazines at a time."
Hanlon hushed Markle before he could respond to the accusation. She wanted to check in on their transport.
"Battle Wrath, this is Viper 1. Are you still in position? Over."
"Viper 1, Battle Wrath. Still holding in Sector 5. Just say the word."
The voice of Battle Wrath, the unit's Chimera armored personnel carrier, was some sort of comfort at least. If things went south, they could withdraw back to the ridgeline at speed. They'd need to, if the artillery newly sighted along the long ash rise started dropping shells. There was another thunderclap, and Hanlon's ears filled with the sudden aching roar of supersonic engines. She allowed herself to half-turn and caught a glimpse of a trio of cruciform shapes whipping through the darkening skies further east. Imperial Navy Thunderbolts climbing into an interceptor run on the greenskin bombers, speckling the dust clouds higher up. Earlier, she'd seen an Orc fighter peeling away, one engine ablaze, pluming foul black smoke as it twisted into a death dive south of the recon team's position. It had struck the ground amidst the blossoming fireball, the explosion reaching Hanlon's ears long seconds after the distant flash of light. She hadn't spotted a chute. She doubted the greenskins fitted their aircraft with any sort of escape precautions anyway. More Imperial fighters rocketed overhead, lightnings this time, lower and faster. They were there and gone in a bang of displaced air, and it took a great deal of effort for the Numerian not to sit up to see their targets above the ridge to her back. She could hear the distant staccato thudding of Hydra anti-aircraft batteries intermingled with the deeper notes of the bombing run detonations. Despite the onset of night, it seemed like the greenskin's aerial bombardment was only intensifying. She checked her wrist chrono. They only had 15 more minutes before sundown, and then the last of what little light was penetrating Ikara 9's dust-shrouded atmosphere would be gone. Another greenskin aircraft ploughed into the wasteland, further north. This time it was a bomber, and the detonation when its payload went up caused a small mushroom cloud of flame and black smoke to flare into existence. Hanlon felt the earth beneath her tremor as the shock waves from the impact traveled through the shifting, unstable ash. She caught more movement, this time a little to the south, on the edge of the sector being watched by a tribe team of Tamaran scalp takers. Another damned greenskin spotter. She was about to call it in when she realized something was out of place. The tremors from the downed bomber hadn't dissipated. She paused, making sure she was right, then tapped the comlink.
"Anyone else still feeling that?"
"The ash is shifting,"
Wilk, the team's vox operator, responded.
"Subterranean activity," Vaughn said.
"Wait, listen," Krevin replied.
Hanlon paused and held her breath, straining for whatever sound the team's pathfinder had picked up. It didn't take her long to hear it, too. Beneath the distant thudding of flak guns and the base crumps of explosions, a noise like a swelling ocean was steadily rising. As it continued to increase in volume, so too did the tremors running beneath the guardsmen. She felt a shudder slip up her spine as she realized what she was hearing. The roaring of thousands of throats and the pounding of thousands of boots. It was the sound of an army of savages on the move, and it was drawing closer. She snapped her magnoculars back up and trained them directly west of the recon team's position. Darkness had shrouded the vague, jagged line that demarcated the ruins that had once been Shepard's most easterly slums, but with the viewfinder set to maximum, Hanlon could see shapes moving out beyond the city's remains. Not the lone skittish motions of one or two Gretchen, but the churning mass of a wall of bodies stampeding east, directly towards her section.
"Great Namara's golden hair!" she cursed. "Wilk, get on the vox and get me the officer of the watch, now!"
Castor. The commanders of the Fulminata, those who yet lived, had gathered in the shadow of General Chevik's headquarters to assess their new position. Castor had seen Field Marshal Kloss arrive at the fortified Envirodome 2 hours earlier, coming from Fifth Corps' dispositions further north. Tyrannus had already spoken with the Field Marshal, and Chevik again in private. Now, as Kloss called a general briefing of all his remaining corps commanders, Tyrannus did the same with his brother Primaris. Besides Castor, 4 of the Brotherhood's 5 surviving sergeants were present. Only Sergeant Nerva was elsewhere, left in command of the squads holding the short stretch of the line at the heart of Ridge 1. Severus was there too, the grim skull helms of both the Reaver and Castor, ensuring those guardsmen stationed close to Chevik's tent gave the transhuman assembly a wide berth. Polixis had been offered a space at the briefing, but had elected to continue working back at the main Medicaid hub, set to the ridge's rear. The others were gathered in a circle, helmets clamped to their hips, bolters locked across thighs or chests, waiting on the word of Lieutenant Tyrannus.
"There has been no word from Brother Captain Demeter," he said.
"May the Emperor guide and watch over his worthy soul," Castor said.
Tyrannus nodded before continuing.
"That being the case, it is my duty to assume complete command of the Fulminata until such times as the captain is recovered, or his death is confirmed."
"The Codex supports your appointment," Lieutenant Samson said firmly, nodding across the circle to Tyrannus. "The captain's final orders were clear, and his sacrifice will not be in vain. Our new defensive lines here will allow us to check this fresh Xenos invasion."
"Agreed, Lieutenant," Tyrannus said. "Nonetheless, we must prepare for the worst. I am ordering the rest of the Demi-Company to maintain its cohesion from now on. We were weakened in Shabbat because we spread our strength too widely. Even if it helped us preserve the guard during the withdrawal, we were unable to land a telling blow against the Xenos. That will not be the case when they come again."
"But for how long are we expected to maintain these positions?" Sergeant Valorius asked. "High Command must be aware of the situation here. We are overextended, still disorganized and heavily outnumbered."
"There are reinforcements coming from Croton," Tyrannus said, "but it will be at least a day before they arrive, and a number more before they are fully deployed. We must be the bulwark until then."
Castor assessed Tyrannus as he briefed his sergeants. He had few doubts about the lieutenant's new command, and yet it was inevitable that it should feel strange, almost sacrilegious. Demeter was not long unaccounted for, and beneath the veneer of a standard situational briefing, Castor could sense the pain of each and every one of the Ultramarines present. All wished they had been at the captain's side when he had taken his stand.
"Do we know the strength of the reinforcements on their way?" Domitian asked.
"Von Klimt has not been forthcoming with exact figures. I suspect the numbers will not be sufficient to launch a counterattack, but they should be enough to stabilize the front. Simply put, that is our primary strategic objective. If we stop the Greenskin warlord here, it will give Imperial forces on Ikara the time to redeploy, and if that is achieved,
it in turn allows the rest of the subsector to shift its weight to this system. At worst, Ergork's new momentum will be halted. At best, he will be trapped and killed. But first, we must hold this ridge.
What about the situation in orbit?
Sergeant Plastis asked.
Is it true the fleet has completely disengaged?
It is. To the best of our knowledge, the Imperial Navy are currently holding station on the system's spinward edge. The Spear of Macragge is with them. They are waiting on reinforcements before contesting orbit. That means the Xenos are in complete control of Ikara 9's anchorage for the foreseeable future. It's a reality we are simply going to have to accept for the time being. Expect them to assert their air superiority over the next few days.
They've withdrawn for now, though,
Domitian pointed out, glancing skywards. There had been no sign of the alien aircraft that had first fallen on them just a few hours earlier.
They are likely refitting, Tyrannus said. Let us pray that remains the case.
Do we have a holding point for our own casualties now that extraction to the Spear of Macragge is impossible?
Valorius asked.
And are our own Thunderhawks and Overlords going to continue to operate out of the Quarton airfields?
As the other spoke, Custer watched Samson. Aside from his opening support of Tyrannus, the lieutenant hadn't spoken since the start of the briefing. His endorsement had been fit and proper. Tyrannus's seniority was unambiguous, and the character of both officers suited their new roles. Tyrannus had always modeled himself after Demeter. Now that respect could help mold him into the commander the Fulminata needed. For his own part, Samson had never progressed beyond the role of a competent second, and Custer wondered sometimes whether he ever would. He was large and stoic, and few could best him gladius to gladius in the sparring pits. He was the very image of a Praetorian of ancient Macragge, with his heavy features and short, curled blonde hair. His silence, however, betrayed the truth behind his deference. He preferred enacting the orders of others rather than issuing them, at least on a company-wide level. Castor didn't doubt he would be an excellent second for Tyrannus, but if the first lieutenant were to become a casualty, the situation might warrant Castor's own intervention.
"Communications from the picket line to the west," Sergeant Faustus said abruptly, interrupting Tyrannus's response to his sergeants.
The Ultramarines had unrestricted access to all the channels and frequencies being used by the Astra Militarum. Faustus automatically pinged the correct signal to the rest of the assembled Ultramarines. Castor listened as a thickly accented Numerian voice blurted over the priority communications band.
"Repeat! Greenskin incursion from the west! They're coming!"
More voices overlaid it, confirmation from the picket units all along the line pouring in. A full-scale Xenos assault was rolling from the city towards Ridge 1. Custer turned west, towards Shibat. The dusk and the ash obscured his view, but he swore he could detect a tremor in the earth and a tidal roar in the air. His fist clenched unconsciously around his Crozius Arcanum's worn grip.
"The picket line is withdrawing," Faustus said. "Field Marshal Kloss is issuing a full stand, too."
"Assemble with your squads, battle brothers," Tyrannus said, unclamping his helm. "This time there will be no retreat."
Hanlon. Hanlon and her recon team ran for their lives. The pounding of their boots against the dry earth was punctuated by the whip-crack of multi-laser fire as the Chimera they were racing towards sent covering fire streaking over their heads, punching pursuing greenskins off their feet and splattering the ash with dark blood. Hanlon smacked her palm against the shoulder of Sergeant Rakin, the Numerian crouching just feet from the transport's open rear hatch, blazing away at the charging Xenos with his rifle on semi-automatic. Transports from the forward observation posts had raced up, ash and dust churning from their tracks, providing a means of exfiltration. It was as Hanlon and her men had raced for their Chimera that things had started to go wrong. The lead elements of the onrushing Orc wave began blazing away with their inaccurate firearms, and shells from the artillery positions embedded into Ridge 1 began hammering down just a few hundred yards from the withdrawing picket line. Great blossoms of ash and dirt, scattered with gory shreds of Xenos meat, burst across the line, the initial impacts throwing the whole recon team to the ground. It was carnage, and Hanlon's team were in the midst of it.
"Go!"
Hanlon bellowed at Rakin, her voice barely audible over the Chimera's engines and the frenzied bellowing of thousands of onrushing aliens. Rakin rose and ran alongside her, both guardsmen pounding up the Chimera's access ramp and into the tight, bare metal troop compartment.
"All in, Battle Wrath!"
Wilk was already shouting into the vehicle's intercom unit.
"Get us out of here!"
The rear hatch began to rise, even as the armored personnel carrier turned sharply east. The recon team inside flung unceremoniously against the fold-down benches to one side of the hold.
"On the Laz arrays!"
Hanlon shouted over the roar of the transport's engines, grabbing the overhead rail before she was thrown down. The rest of the squad snatched at the stocks of the Laz guns built into the Chimera's hull, the troop benches acting as a low firing step as they angled them downwards and started to fire. Hanlon peered out of the armored Laz vision slit in the Chimera's rear. The narrow view showed only a horde of greenskins and the ash cloud kicked up from the transport's tracks. Gunfire flared in the gloom, and she heard the sharp crack of rounds ricocheting from the vehicle's ramp and rear armor. A flurry of bright Laz beams streaked back into the oncoming mob. The turret multilaser had been rotated 180 degrees. For a second, the lieutenant felt a surge of relief. They were pulling away from the Orc charge now, and the dust was beginning to shroud them. Just a few more minutes, and they'd be hitting the base of Ridge 1, under the cover of Imperial lines. The moment of reprieve didn't last long. The panicked voice of the Chimera's driver blurted over the intercom.
"Contact right! Contact right!"
Hanlon just had time to register the words before she heard a loud clang from the right-hand side of the hull.
"They're right outside!"
Vaughn screamed, still firing his hull lasgun.
"Thrown! Where did they come from?"
Nobody answered. The Chimera pitched suddenly to the left, hard. Hanlon lost her grip on the overhead rail and grunted as she slammed into the side of the hold. At the same moment, a detonation slammed through the transport, like a hammer striking an anvil, shuddering the whole vehicle and making the Nemerian's ears ring. Hanlon reached for the troop bench, trying to right herself, dazed and sluggish. She touched her brow and realized she was bleeding from a gash above her left eye. Smoke was filling the hold, stinking and black.
"We're not moving," Markle said, groggily. "Why have we stopped?"
Only then did Hanlon, her head spinning, realize that they'd come to a standstill. Wilk found his feet first. He banged the exit room, coughing as more smoke poured into the hold. The rear ramp dropped, thudding down into ash churned by the Chimera's tracks. Hanlon saw immediately that those tracks were no more. The blast had scattered broken links from the right-hand runner across the dusty earth.
"Out!"
she managed to bark, scrambling to her feet and down the fallen ramp. Initially, she could see nothing amidst the churning ash. Her world had been reduced to the filmy lenses of her goggles and the rattle and scrape of her respirator mask. She spun back towards the Chimera and saw the scorch marks all along its right side. Something had clamped onto its flank and detonated, leaving the vehicle useless and immobile. That wasn't Hanlon's most immediate concern, though. There were greenskins attacking the Chimera's crew compartment. Even at a glance, Hanlon could see they weren't like regular orcs. They moved, hunched, low to the ground, and were clad in what looked like the ragged, dusty approximation of her team's recon capes and spotting goggles. One had used what looked like a las cutter combined with a welder to sear a hole in the flank of the Chimera's forward section, and now others were dragging the hapless crew out into the ash. Battle Wrath's commander was screaming horrifically as one of the grunting aliens crudely butchered him with a huge cleaver, and two others had grasped the driver and were physically tearing